Okay, our next speaker, or our last speaker just before we break for coffee, is Captain Rick Newson from the UK Civil Aviation Authority Safety Research Group. And I'm not sure where your presentation is, so I'm hoping you know which one yours is.
Me too. That's not my slide, that's all right. There we are.
It might be after mine.
No, it wasn't. It went... Is it that one?
Let's have a look. Which one left?
That's C-Store.
Not mine.
I don't think...
Has he got it on a stick?
Did
okay.
you
get... I gave the chap the stick.
Oh, well, he did drag it in there.
Did he?
Yeah, I thought I saw him doing that. Is it not this one?
Try that one out. The one above it. 21st of May.
Hey, that looks good.
It's a CRM thing. Good afternoon. My name is Rick Newson from the CAA. I'd like to thank Rick Haybrook and the HFG for inviting me along today to give a CAA perspective on the implementation of single pilot CRM. Because I work for the Flight Operations Department, Flight Ops Helicopters, I'm a helicopter pilot, my input is for regulation of commercial air transport operations, and that's really where I'm going to be directing this afternoon's chat. For those that don't know who we are, the Civil Aviation Authority are 12 wise men and women in our London office. We've got another office at Gatwick Airport. And underneath the 12 wise men and women, we have a number of groups. I work for the Safety Regulation Group, and there are a number of other organisations, or another entities within the organisation that deal with all aspects of legislation and implementation thereof. The thing we work towards is the Air Navigation Order, which is the aviation law of the land. We have to have that. ICAO sets that in Montreal, that all countries that operate aircraft should operate to a common standard. And CAP 393, Civil Air Publication 393, specifies all of the legislative requirements that we operate to. So, how do we do that? We have flight ops and training inspectors. I'm both flight ops and a training inspector. And we travel the country carrying out an audit program. That audit program of the assigned companies we have in our charge includes the list that you see on the wall there. Arguably, the most important for me as a flight ops inspector is the content of the company's operations manual. And in there sets the standard for that company. The tail end of the ops manual, they go from part A to part D, and part D is the training manual. And in the back end, we tend to find the CRM section of a company's training philosophy. Now, the manual itself and the requirement to have a manual through the Air Operator Certificate isn't necessarily law. However, when we issue an AOC against a company, it is embolstered against a single paragraph in the Air Navigation Order, which says the CAA must be satisfied that an operator is competent to operate an aircraft in accordance with his crewing, training, testing, da-di-da-di-da. So we've got one broad catch-all, which is we must be satisfied. Now, there's only seven of us in the helicopter world, and we look after 100 or so AOCs, which includes commercial air transport AOCs and police AOCs. We deem the police to be commercial air transport, interestingly. So seven of us look after 100 companies, and out of 100 companies, obviously there's 100 ops manuals to look at, and we are deluged with the company standards. More about that in a minute. As you can see, we, as I've already said, we travel the country. Not only do we look at the paperwork, but the most important thing is we get to know the operator, and we visit them, we fly with them, we inspect them, and we get to have a very close working relationship. One of the groups within the CAA is an enforcement branch. If we find that it's been a flagrant breaking of the rules, then obviously we can use our policemen against you and bash heads. That is a very rare occurrence. We like to think that we're not quite HSE types. We work very closely with the companies that we're assigned, and hopefully we both come to a common goal. With the flight ops inspectors, we have to have a broad brush background of the job we're embarking upon in legislating. With me, it's obviously a helicopter ops inspector, so my background is flying helicopters. I started off by trying to keep submarines sunk a few years ago. Once I'd managed the craft without sinking a single submarine, I left the Navy and was engaged in blue light operations with a company in the West Country. So I flew a number of aircraft. The one that was most interesting to me was the bottom in the middle there, the Schweitzer, for Warwickshire Police. They affectionately called that the Strimmer, for obvious reasons. But I've flown not only in the multi-pilot role, but clearly in the single-pilot role in the blue light environment. after 20-odd years of doing that, decided perhaps the dark side was another option. So joined the CAA, where I thought, for my first 6 months of learning all the legislation, the desk was it. But nope, that's not the way we do business. We have to continue flying. I fly 4 days, it's meant to be 4 days a month, but as a training inspector, I probably do another 6 or 7 on top of that. So I'm actually flying quite a bit throughout the working month. I fly for Bond Offshore Helicopters up in Aberdeen, and I also fly for the Metropolitan Police on the EC-145. In fact, for those of you that have been reading the recent press, that is Delta November, the aircraft whose rotor head came off just some few weeks ago, killing 16 people on board. I didn't realise that until I looked at the slides this morning. So, hopefully, we've all got a penchant for the subject we're talking about and inspecting. Right now, we have a very challenging time in the light AOC world. There are 210 AOCs. Across the board, this is heavy aeroplanes, light aeroplanes, helicopters. 30 or so of those have been suspended or revoked. Everyone's having a tough time right now. The AOC charging scheme is causing a lot of problems to a lot of small operators. The big boys, the British Airways versions of this world, were subsidising the lower end of the tiddlers in the marketplace. Some 4 or 5 years ago, there was a meeting at the CAA, and those subsidies were removed. Therefore, to balance the books, the smaller tiddlers have had to pay more. And that's a staged increase. And if you think that 4 or 5 years ago, a small AOC was probably paying 1,200 quid for an AOC, then they could be, at the end of 5 years, be paying somewhere in the region of 20,000 to operate a single aircraft. Trying to recoup that under the current regime is very, very difficult. We've also had a number of legislative changes. Joint aviation requirements and regulations onto EU ops for aeroplanes. That's required an awful lot of work at company level to get up to speed with the new documentation. Likewise, transition from EU ops to EASA ops, or JAR ops 3 in the case of helicopters, to EU ops. Sorry, EASA ops rather. See, I'm getting it wrong as well. It's a very, very difficult and time-consuming period for the industry. Throw in the fuel charges and the recession effects, difficult. So what is my concern, having another sort of sideline interest within the CAA, which is CRM, is CRM seen as core business? Hopefully, those of you who sat here at the Royal Aeronautical Society are here for a reason. We all understand it is. However, there are those companies out there that really don't see it that way. If it's not a legislative requirement, maybe we'll let it slip. And that certainly is a view as we travel and inspect. We see that cropping up at the moment. So what do I do as a single pilot operator with regards to CRM? Well, JAR Ops 3 and EU Ops are quite specific in what's required of you. So what is a single pilot operator? Any aircraft certified below 5,700 kilos could be flown single pilot. There are some strange quirks out there from engine management systems that would require a second set of hands. But generally speaking, if it's under 5,700 kilos, it could be flown by a single pilot. Now, how many are there out there? Well, having spoken to licensing yesterday, believe it or not, there are 20,000 in the UK commercial pilots, and something like 5,000 of those are currently rated, and rated only on aircraft under 5,700 kilos. And that surprised me. I thought it was going to be much less than that. However, they could be operated multi-crew. The customer requirement could be for a second pilot. So is it relevant? Well, yeah, unlike a lot of the world's scheduled services from airport to airport in a very controlled environment, a lot of the light under 5-7 kilo operators are carrying out a job of work in difficult circumstances. You can see Pipeline aircraft, top right-hand corner there, Loganair, Islander, single pilot, Jet Ranger, air ambulance operations, transplant runs in the middle of the night. Most of this work is ad hoc. And by inference, you don't know what's coming through the door. And unfortunately, some of the people flying these aircraft are inexperienced. That's where they start. They gain their experience, then they move on to where the money is, the big airlines. Unfortunately, this is also where the accident rate is. You might make the big airlines might make the news. Unfortunately, throughout the working year, these guys are getting it wrong. Well, I'm going to air my dirty washing then. That was me in 1992 flying a twin squirrel for Thames Valley Police. I've no idea to this day why I was there, apart from it was a nice photograph. So one of the observers got out and took a lovely photograph. That was on a Saturday. That was on the Sunday. The snow had cleared. It was in a North Oxfordshire village, and I'm sat there having my breakfast with the other two police observers, and the phone rang. Ambulance control, could you come and do a casualty evacuation of a young lad who's been run over by a skip lorry? No problem at all. So we ran to the aircraft, jumped in it, flew up to North Newington, which is about 10 minutes flying time north of Oxford, looked at the scene, and from 500 feet you could see exactly what it looked like, a traumatic amputation of a leg, young lad stuck underneath a skip lorry, a paramedic screaming on the radio, you must land, we've got to get this guy to hospital. So I landed on the road, which you see quite regularly on 999 and all these fantastic TV programmes on a Friday night. Unfortunately, there was a local photographer popped out the bushes for the local rag, took that photograph. For those of you that fly helicopters, you'll realise that if I'd had lowered the collective lever, my blades would have hit the trees to the left-hand side of the aircraft. I had to physically keep power on to keep the aircraft light on the skids. And the next Monday morning, the newspaper headlines read, "Hero pilot saves life." And it should have said, "Complete pillock nearly kills three," but because it was a bad decision. It sounded good at the time, and the young lad got away with it in the end. But that sort of thing it goes on regularly in the single pilot world. There isn't the check and balance system of a second pilot. You may have a crew member, a technical crew member with you. You might actually have a very bullshy, drunk, high-class customer who's also sat next to you coming back from a horse event. And those pressures are huge. I'm not going to sit here and dwell on this because you all know this subject. However, for those that don't know the sort of intricacies of the CRM, I initially pulled this off of a Flight International page, 2003, I think. But it looks at the sort of very generalised type of error committed by aircrew. It's looking at general aviation, airlines and military, very broad catch-all. The three types of error they were looking at was decisional errors, perceptual motor errors, that's the hand-eye gaffes that you often make, and procedural error. Procedural error is exactly what it says. It's not following procedures. But you can see the one that stands out loud and proud amongst all of the errors there is plain old making a bad decision. And that's level with all three. Look at general aviation. No procedural errors, really. Why? They don't fly procedures, generally speaking. And I suspect most single-pilot commercial air transport operators have very little in the way of procedures also, especially if they're an ad hoc charter organisation. Now, when we're implementing CRM, through the eyes of the CAA, the thing I say to the other ops inspectors who don't have the same sort of level of interest that I have in the subject at the moment, when you interpret the rules, you've got to think aeroplane, you've got to think heavy metal, think multi-pilot. That's the bulk of the work that was done by the CRM advisory panel. We've tried to put right the single pilot elements 2 to 3 years ago, I think, Colin, something like that. And we developed chapter 17, I think it is, which is the single pilot concepts. But generally speaking, most of the material you'll find in CAP 737 is derived from that background. The thing to do as a single pilot operator is to take ownership and make it fit your environment. Don't try and make a round peg fit a square hole. It won't work. Find out what you want from CRM training and then develop it your way. So CAP 737 on the single pilot side looks at some areas I've put on the board here. I've not put them all up. They're all equally important in their own right. Workload management, in my view, is probably the most single important thing. When the workload goes up, good example, you could be a single pilot in cloud at night, high-value customer, wants to get back to his race course or wherever he lives, and you have an engine problem. Your workload is very, very high. It could be that you're trying to navigate with a map and a torch in your mouth. Believe it or not, there are still aircraft around that require you to do that rather than having spotlights and things. When I was taught as a young Navy pilot, it was aviate, navigate, communicate. That's all very well and good when you've got somebody else to help you do that. When you're trying to do it on your own and prioritise the workload, extremely difficult. Error management. I was on a CRM course with somebody yesterday and the subject of handling engines on a helicopter came up. In my previous company, we had a number of FADEC fitted aircraft, the MD-902 Explorer, and engine control switches, which are literally taken from a VW Golf, I think. They're off, idle, fly and train. And before taking off, what one does is make sure both engines are in fly. They could actually be both in train if you turn them fully to the right. But the amount of pilots that try to lift with one engine at idle and the other one at fly. So simple check and balance as a single pilot was introduced to have a checklist. And if you didn't have a second crew member, such as a paramedic or a police officer, was to then go through a challenge and response checklist yourself. So sit there and challenge yourself as if you had your alter ego sat next to you. Anything you can put in place before you go flying, hopefully would work. Decision-making, communication, situational awareness, and health areas, all equally applicable. Now, JAR introduced the concept of training to be conducted by suitably qualified personnel. In the UK, CAP 737 introduces the concept of the crew resource management instructor. And we split those into three areas: ground, simulator and base, which is in the air, and the line environment. Now, there are something, like I've already said, in the helicopter world, 100 AOCs, probably something like 80 of those are single pilot operators. Aeroplane world, we've got about 120 AOCs, of which 65, 66, I think, are single pilot operators. Very small organisations, they tend to be. And what we're looking at then is individuals within those tiny companies, which could be a single aircraft flown by a chief pilot, maybe the owner, also a line trainer, maybe also the base trainer. And we're now asking him to become, or at least appoint somebody, to look after CRMI base, CRMI line, and CRMI ground. Clearly that's not going to work. And the economies of scale say, pull together and hopefully get the resources that way. So who are they? Now this is for those, obviously, that haven't followed this subject closely over the last few years. A ground CRM course is to be conducted by a suitably qualified CRMI ground. In the UK, we have a fantastically structured system now. Observations by examiners, members of the CRM advisory panel, training inspectors who go out there and make sure the standards are very high. Unfortunately, that's not a level playing field across Europe at the moment. And with EASA coming, we are definitely going to see a ramp of standards across the whole of the European states. At the lighter end of the market, we've also got a number of very experienced ground CRMIs who come from varying backgrounds. We've got some who've come from the multi-pilot world, who've left the multi-pilot world, who are now teaching single pilot operators who don't quite understand the marketplace, and vice versa. So we're getting onto that as a regulator now, and hopefully sort of banging the drum loud enough to make that, unlike a square peg in a round hole, take ownership of it, and hopefully we'll start to see the results. When we're looking at certification of pilots, at the light end of the market, it is quite acceptable to have a certificate to prove that you have been on a third-party course. But that third-party course, as I've just said, must really have been in a similar environment, operating environment, as your own. And once again, share your company resources. I already mentioned that CRMI E's, examiners, qualify CRMI ground. And who qualifies the examiner? Well, that'll be training inspectors from the CAA and, more likely than not, suitably qualified members of the CRM advisory panel. We've seen varying standards, actually. Most of the standard of the ground is improving. Standard of the examiners, we're working hard. We're traditionally having one every other year. Colin at Gatwick have a meeting to try and improve the examiner standards. So if you ever see those advertised, please come along. Very worthwhile. Right, in the air, microjets. Ooh, that's another subject entirely. It's highly possible that you will carry out your 6-monthly operator's proficiency check in the aircraft because there is no simulator available to fly. Now that clearly poses some problems. It means you as the TRE will be in the other pilot seat. You are physically putting engines to idle or into a train mode. You're physically putting the aircraft in what is essentially an unsafe predicament. Hopefully everything will be resolved before you land in a safe manner. However, what one should be conducting as a CRMI is looking for the golden nuggets. Left engine, right engine, correct engine, one engine, two engine, all those little things that a pilot can get confused with, you should be looking for as the non-flying pilot, as the examiner. Facilitation skills, hugely important. Facilitating a useful flight starts before you've even started the brief, how you present yourself as an instructor examiner. The debrief is absolutely critical. I'm jumping ahead here to the simulator element of this chat. I was in the simulator this week in another country looking at a UK CRMIE using a couple of foreign sim instructors who don't do CRM training at all. And just from an unusual attitude entry, 30 degrees nose up and 20 degrees left wing low, I think it was, the aircraft crashed. And the two of us in the back just sat here, and it became a fantastic exercise of a facilitative debrief. And these guys learned an awful lot about CRM skills with CAP 737 on the desk, page by page. We've also introduced a requirement for the assessment of CRM skills. You've already heard about behavioural markers today, so I'm not going to dwell on that. However, the one drum we are banging quite loudly is if you are going to use a behavioural marker scheme, know how to use it. Don't just go ahead, sit there at the debrief and tick the boxes. Actually look for the areas in the flight as a whole, holistically, and then use the behavioural marker scheme during the debrief. Now, self-assessment. If you are a single pilot, no one's going to see you making these strange behaviours in flight, the little cock-ups that you make and correct yourself. So the most important thing to drum home as a TRE is when you do make these mistakes, crew room gossip. Tell the lads about it. I've made a mistake today. I've had my dirty washing. Obviously, the simulator is a much more controlled environment. We don't have many sims, I've already mentioned, in the light aeroplane and helicopter world. But it does allow, obviously, CRM situations to develop. That I've already mentioned to some extent, there are a significant number of simulator training providers outside of the UK, and most of them, a significant proportion of them, are unqualified. What we have been requiring as a regulator is that if a UK operator wishes to use a foreign simulator facility, that the simulator provider meets the UK standards, so he becomes a TRE and accredited as a CRMI. We do have a number of foreign TREs under the JAL system, the EASA system, who we are now visiting with a view to conducting purely the CRM assessment and filling in the missing element. And that's something we're going to look at much more closely over the next year or two. And likewise, if a company is using a nominated individual to conduct his checks on OPC, LPC, that sort of thing, then they must know your SOPs. It's all very well just jumping in and dealing with an emergency situation from the checklist, but they must know the company philosophy and culture and use of the behavioural marker system if applicable. And of course, if it's commercial air transport, yes, it's applicable. I've no idea where that came from. I quite like it there. The line check. Huge problem for us, the line check. I've already mentioned that we have examiners qualifying instructors in the CRMI line environment. How does a CRMI line become qualified? Very, very difficult for some of the aircraft that we operate to facilitate a seat for the examiner, a seat for the CRMI line instructor and the pilot. And, of course, the job that he's doing. Maybe the high-profile customer, maybe the casualty, screaming and shouting with a paramedic jumping up and down on him. So it's very, very difficult. What we're saying is yes, you've got the core skills that are required from CAP 737, but maybe these core skills can be honed in the classroom, in a workshop environment. And that's the way we're addressing most of the CRMI line qualifications at the moment, through workshop. It could also be done on multiple aircraft types. So rather than just waiting to get hold of PA-34 operators only in the region, why not get air taxi operators in the region, all flying slightly different aircraft types, but they're flying a slightly similar role. Get them together and talk through their problems. Video material, some years ago, must be sort of 5 or 6 years ago, the JARTEL videos, those of you that may have seen them, very good material for a multi-crew operator. Gives you a good stab at briefing and debriefing upon some skills that you've seen poorly exhibited in an aircraft. We're desperately trying to find material through the Human Factors Group at the moment for operators to use. We've made one video 18 months ago based upon a helicopter ambulance operation, which has gone down very well. We've commissioned another video in an aeroplane air charter operation, which we're going to do at Bournemouth in the next few months. But if anybody has any other video material in the single pilot vein, please come and bang on the door of the CAA or the CRM advisory panel. We could use it. So, current observations from the single pilot CRM within the industry. We're now starting to see that maybe 15 years ago, when we had lots of new technology reaching the complex aeroplane world, we're now getting some more complex and significantly complex lighter aircraft. Three-stroke, four-axis autopilots, when you're talking about helicopters, EFIS, FADEC, TCAS, TORS, EGPWS, electronic flight bags. Lots of situational awareness problems there for a single pilot with a massive workload. All these things have been developed to reduce workload. Actually, when you've got that much in the cockpit, it can increase the workload. So a current problem we've got, I see it regularly when I'm doing initial instrument ratings. These young lads in these new technology machines, bristling with kit, sometimes have problems with it. Poor decision making is becoming cited in a number of accidents and incidents. Keep watching the AAIB for that one. And we need to be focusing more on the single pilot issues. Finishing bang on 2 o'clock. I will save the questions to the end. Thanks very much.
That's what I'd like to see. We're back on time. So now we're just going to break for tea. It's where we had it this morning. And if I can ask you to all be back promptly at 20.